In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we have political scientist Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, where he's professor of political science in Ames there. Also Donna Hoffman with us. She is likewise professor of political science, but at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna Hoffman, Jim McCormick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. We want to welcome our listeners to this hour. And first up to bat will be the debate, again, about gun violence and what our elected officials are talking about in connection with it in reducing gun violence. Join our conversation with your questions. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, we want to talk about how President Biden wants to reshape the American economy. He has three words emphasizing infrastructure, climate, and equality. Also, what to do with the sharp rise, about the sharp rise in the number of migrants fleeing violence, natural disasters, also just economic hardship in Central America. We hope to get to those. And we heard in the top of the hour news the advances made in the U.S. Senate about the sweeping federal elections overhaul that Democrats hope to put into place. But first of all, let's talk about the gun debate. In the span of a week, at least 18 people have died in two high-profile mass shootings. We've heard this sort of news again and again and again over the years. Still so hard to imagine the grief of the families involved and the senselessness of these shootings. After the second deadly mass shooting in a week, the president has urged Congress to swiftly pass gun control laws and may take action on his own to stop mass violence. The Democrats called on the Senate to approve two bills passed by the House of Representatives back in March that would broaden background checks on gun buyers. Let's listen to the president. Biden called for a ban on assault-style weapons and high-capacity ammo magazines.
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common-sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again. I got that done when I was a senator. It passed. It was law for the longest time. And it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again.
Okay, Republicans responded as they have many times in the past. Here's Republican Senator Ted Cruz accusing Democrats of playing political theater for proposing gun control measures that he claims would be ineffective.
And every time there's a shooting, we play this ridiculous theater where this committee gets together and proposes a bunch of laws that would do nothing to stop these murders. Senator from Connecticut just said the folks on the other side of the aisle have no solutions. Well, the senator from Connecticut knows that is false. Today, Chairman Grassley and I are introducing again Grassley-Cruz, and I would ask Senate Democrats, including some of our newer colleagues who just got here, not to participate again in the shameful filibuster that this body engaged in 2013. Let's target the bad guys, the felons, the fugitives, those with mental disease. Let's put them in jail. Let's stop them from getting guns. Let's not scapegoat innocent law-abiding citizens, and let's not target their constitutional rights.
Donna Hoffman, let me go to you first of all. What are you seeing in the congressional reaction to these latest tragic shootings?
Well, first we should note that the hearings that were held in the Senate were already scheduled before these two mass shootings took place. And so, as you noted in your introduction, the House has passed a couple of bills. One would expand background checks for gun sales and transfers, and the other one would extend the review period on that. And so that's the impetus, really, for addressing the issue in the Senate, having these hearings in the Senate, because the House has acted on some things. Now, these two bills were passed in the previous Congress by the House, but the Senate was under control of Republicans, so they did not get a hearing in the Senate. And as we know, the Senate is evenly divided, 50-50. But because Schumer can schedule hearings, Democrats can schedule hearings, they control in that aspect, they are doing that, which was not done in previous Congresses. And so, you know, this draws attention to the issue. Mass shootings draw attention to the issue. One of the things we know, however, about public opinion on this issue is that, you know, you can look at public opinion poll after public opinion poll in which the public will say, by pretty large margins typically, that they support various efforts related to gun legislation. However, the salience of this issue kind of waxes and wanes. It comes and goes. After a mass shooting, it's particularly salient. People are looking at it, talking about it. But then it quickly fades. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not an important issue, but it doesn't rise in public opinion polling to a question that pollsters tend to ask on the most important issue. They ask voters, what is the most important issue? It doesn't tend to get very high in that, and that's a measure of salience. And it also can be important in terms of looking at how well does Congress or any legislative body act on a particular issue? Is it salient with the public? And so we tend to not get anything passing. And it also, as we'll see probably in this time, hinges on some of the procedural mechanisms within the Senate. We know there's currently a debate on whether the legislative filibuster should be retained or should be gotten rid of, because effectively you need that 60 vote to shut off debate in the Senate. And so there are a lot of variation there, but it certainly is the case that, you know, we elect members to represent us, whether it's in a state legislature, whether it's in Congress, to, you know, reflect public wishes on policy issues. But those are never one-to-one, and there are a lot of intervening variables, if you will, that affect whether or not Congress or any legislative body is representative in this sense.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation as we discuss the politics of gun violence. Donna Hoffman and Jim McCormick are political scientists. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. In those Senate hearings, Donna and Jim, the amazing statistic, more than 41,000 people killed in just in last year by gun violence in this country, a record. Jim McCormick, Donna touched on the new parts of our political landscape, a new president, a new Congress, where Democrats control a majority, if so very slight. Do you see, Jim, anything on this political landscape that might bring a different outcome for proponents of gun safety restrictions?
I guess pessimistically, I really don't see any real possibility here. I mean, because, you know, part of the argument is that the Republicans would make or have made is that even this legislation, which was going to tighten background checks and so on, probably would not have, you know, prevented some of these attacks here. And I think the larger issue for those in opposed to further gun control is that what really is trying to be enacted here is a kind of a gun registry, and they see that as a great assault on the Second Amendment. So that divide is pretty broad, and to try to get around that is going to be very difficult. Now, if they go to lifting the filibuster, I suppose that would be a possibility of getting legislation passed here. But there's obviously political risk for the Democrats in terms of lifting the filibuster here. So I think we're back to square one here, largely. You know, whether the president can use sort of executive authority,
yeah.
I mean, he's also said that he might use an executive order to say, you know, his comment was on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And he might be able to exercise or issue, I should say, an executive order in that regard. although I'm not quite sure what legislative power he would draw on. There's at least seems to be some legislation passed in terms of Gun Control Act that he might be able to cite, or he might just cite his own constitutional powers in ensuring, you know, sort of the basically the safety of the American public, making certain that the laws are faithfully executed. But I think it's quite a lift here to get legislation passed. And I think, Donna makes a very good point here in terms of how much will this issue really engage the American public. The public is generally in favor of tighter gun control legislation. And sort of the NRA, you know, of course, is in a kind of a bankruptcy situation now, the National Rifle Association. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not in a good position to lobby as effectively as perhaps in the past. I suppose so. There might be some openings there, but I do think it's going to be difficult.
Join our conversation with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa Politics Wednesday edition of our program, starting off with the aftermath, political aftermath in this case, repercussions of those two high-profile shootings within a week of each other. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Tom is with us from Des Moines. What's on your mind in the context of this debate, Tom?
Yes, I'm a frequent listener, sometimes caller, and I would like to introduce something new to the discussion on gun control, something that's normally not talked about. Mm-hmm. And that is that we need to deproliferate guns. We need to fight the gun culture that says that when a stranger carries a gun on the street, that we should feel safer. And most of us, if we see a stranger on the street with a gun, we feel less safe if we're honest with ourselves. And so that undermines everything the gun culture and the Republican Party are teaching us about this. We cannot sanction open carry laws with that attitude. So we have to not just do common sense gun legislation like the Democrats say, but we have to start the process of deproliferating weapons on the street. We need to do gun buybacks. We need to undermine this idea that the only solution to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, because once you put a gun in anybody's hand, that person becomes less of a good guy. So you need to have a completely different orientation to this legislatively than I'm hearing in the discussion.
Okay. Tom, thank you very much for your input. What do you think of Tom's suggestion, Donna?
Well, you know, Tom brings up an interesting point, fighting that notion of gun culture. I just read this morning an interesting article where a group of National Guard soldiers from Texas was escorting vaccines to a small rural town in Texas. They were in a caravan, and a gentleman with a gun held them up, stopped this caravan, of which there were multiple National Guard members in this caravan, but they were unarmed. The one guy with the gun was armed. They were unarmed, and the article made this point, is because they were just doing a domestic delivery duty, and typically when they do that kind of duty, the National Guard is unarmed. And that goes a long way in thinking about, I mean, we might expect, how could this have happened, right? That the National Guard, of course they're armed. They are not always armed. And, you know, that kind of goes in line with thinking about gun culture in the United States, this notion of in times of high anxiety and high stress, we typically see gun sales in the United States go up. We've seen that in the pandemic. And it's part of our entertainment culture. It's part of broader culture, as Tom points out. That, however, is a really difficult lift in terms of combating that. It is something that has to be changed, you know, little by little by little. Mm-hmm. And typically in our culture, we've seen it go the other way.
Right, right. And I think, Jim, you jump in here too, because Tom in Des Moines is making the point that to change the culture around guns. But what I am recalling, Jim, see if this matches what yours, is that this idea that more guns make us safer, not less safe, is something that has really taken hold from a fringe idea to a more mainstream idea within the past, say, 5 years, roughly.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, with some of these school shootings and so on, you know, the talk has been, well, if there were just somebody that was armed there, they might have actually prevented this. So this has been, this kind of a view has come into play here. And I was just noting, you know, that there, I don't know if we'll get to it. You know, there's a bill in the state legislature that has been passed. But
yes,
I was really surprised by the number of background checks and obviously the number of purchases of weapons, even in the state of Iowa here. So it really has sort of taken off, you know, even in the state of Iowa, in terms of, you know, that having guns will elicit more protection for you. I sort of agree with the caller that when I see somebody with a gun, I sort of try to move the other way as quickly as possible. Right. Because, you know, I guess my impulse is I'm not sure what their intent is. And so I think that, you know, trying to rid the society of this kind of need for, you know, sort of self-protection here on a regular basis is obviously a direction that we would like to move. But it so much clashes, as you know, with all of the publicity about the Second Amendment and taking away rights and, you know, the whole kind of environment that we've had over the last really decades, I suppose, but at least certainly over the last decade, about infringement upon on personal liberties here. So that's sort of the clash, too, that comes into play, even where I think that culturally it would be much better if we could ease the kind of notion that having guns beside us, and you know, we now even have a member of Congress, you know, that has guns and holsters and all of that sort of thing. So that just reinforces this kind of view.
Join our discussion 1-866-780-9100. And Jim, to your point, yes, we will talk specifically for a few minutes about the bill on Governor Reynolds' desk that would change Iowa's handgun laws. But before that, let's keep on the federal level right now in the reaction. Sean is with us in Ames. What's your input? Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? So I just kind of wanted to get your guys' opinion on the murder rates per capita. Considering that the United States is pretty much the only country in the world that allows their citizens to own guns, you know, you can argue maybe Canada and Switzerland, but aside from those, pretty much no other countries allow their citizens to own guns. But the murder rate is very similar here in the United States. The average is about 3 out of 100,000 people murdered. And that's pretty similar across the board when you look at Europe. So how do you explain the fact that people are still getting murdered at the same rate? Or I guess I just wanted to get your take on that.
My research, and let our experts chime in here, Sean, but what I've been reading is that the U.S. has the world's highest rate of civilian gun ownership. This is from Rand Corporation research that I've noted here. And a gun fatality rate consistently higher than other rich nations. Jim, do you have any way to compare this to the rest of the world, the stats in mind to answer the question there?
Well, I can just make one comment. For example, our neighbor to the north, you know, Canada, they had a great debate over long gun prohibitions because they do have you know, restrictions on, you know, handguns and that sort of thing. But, you know, there are obviously a lot of hunting in Canada. And so this was a great debate about a decade ago within Canada. I'm less sure about all the statistics for Europe. And I'll defer to others on that. But it seems to me my impression, Ben, is that I sort of agree with the point that you made about the sort of the high homicide rate that we have within the United States and the amount of gun deaths here, I think put us in a sort of a category by ourselves here. And I noticed even on your midday newscast, you know, that China has now, you know, again, another kind of litany of items of critique of the U.S. was talking about this kind of excessive gun violence within the United States.
Okay, let's take another caller and get a comment from Donna before we go to break. Bill is with us from Cedar Falls. Bill, welcome to the program. We're coming up on a break. I'll have to ask you to be concise. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call. My question or comment concerns the potential use of big data to enhance our red flag responses. New York Times did a story probably 18 months ago looking at the profiles of especially the younger murderers. And typically they take out a credit card, they max it out on guns and ammunition, and within a month, according to their statistics, they commit the crime. Mm-hmm. We are reported on just about everything we can think of buying, and it shows up on your internet feed before you know it. Why cannot we use big data from the banks and the credit card companies when we see a pattern of a gun and ammunition purchase and often then tactical gear, body armor? Mm-hmm. These are the people that statistically now are committing most of the murders. And look at the two recent cases. So why can't we pass a law that says, okay, we got big data on us on just about everything. Why not some big data reporting on lethal weapons and ammunition?
Okay, Bill, an interesting proposal, comment. Donna, may I go to you for your reaction to Bill's idea?
Sure. There are, yeah. Some of the critics of that kind of approach will point to privacy concerns related to that. And that is, there is a balance in a free society with rights and responsibilities. This is a good example of that. The big data, one of the things about big data just generally is that, that's based on some kind of algorithm typically that someone is composing to do these red flags. And we know that humans make those algorithms and humans can make mistakes in those algorithms. And sometimes those mistakes, which we have seen with policing and some other areas, have racial disparities in them. And so big data is a new and emerging field in terms of using to try to help solve a lot of public policy problems. But we also have to make sure that in using that, we are doing due diligence on privacy concerns, racial concerns, not amplifying some disparities that exist in American society.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with our political analysts. Donna Hoffman, you heard just there, at the University of Northern Iowa. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. When we come back, we'll be to continue talking a little bit more about guns, specifically Iowa. At the same time, this national debate has been inflamed once again. Iowans would be able to purchase and carry handguns without permits if Governor Kim Reynolds signs a bill passed along party lines that the Iowa legislature sent to her desk on Monday. Reynolds' spokesperson declined comment on the legislation. We'll talk about it when we come back and hear a for and against voice from our own Iowa legislature about the new change to handgun laws here in Iowa. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick and Donna Hoffman. It's a Politics Wednesday edition. Back in just a few moments.
The legislative session is scheduled for 110 days. And there will be hundreds of bills proposed this year.
I would like to call the subcommittee meeting to order.
From subcommittees to committees.
I really want to support this bill.
To the chamber floor.
Every senator has voted. The secretary will close the voting system.
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, walks you through the legislative process. I'm John Pimple. Subscribe to Under the Golden Dome with your podcast listening program or hear it at iowapublicradio.org.
And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. The first half, we're talking about the politics of gun violence. Of course, that new outbreak of mass shootings prompting calls for legislation from the president to renew bans on assault rifles and high-capacity ammunition magazines. We did have that. That had a sunset rule. It expired in 2004, I believe. Let's talk a little bit about the Iowa angle here, coinciding with this national debate. Iowans would be able to purchase and carry handguns without
permits. If Governor Kim Reynolds signs a bill passed along party lines that the legislature sent to her on Monday, a spokesman for Reynolds declined to comment on that legislation. She has, though, previously said Iowa has, in her words, reasonable and responsible gun laws on the books, and that she believes the current permit system, for which she voted for as state senator back in 2010, should remain in place. Let's listen to a couple of voices from our lawmakers here in the state during this debate. Republican Senator Jason Schultz of Schleswig says Iowans shouldn't have to prove themselves not guilty to exercise what he considers to be a fundamental right of buying a gun.
Our system of permits is one of mistrust. That means you can exercise a fundamental right, but you must prove yourself not guilty in advance. That is not how America is supposed to work.
Contrast that with Cedar Rapids Democrat Senator Rob Hoag. He says gun permits should still be required.
It's one of the reasons that with higher gun ownership in Iowa, we actually have a lower rate of gun violence. It's because we have laws that support responsible gun ownership, not gun ownership for bad guys.
Jim McCormick, you raised this in our first half hour, the Iowa law change, perhaps, should the governor sign it. In recent years under Republican control, our legislature, Jim, has expanded gun rights legislation. I'm wondering, what about your thoughts on that, how Iowa perhaps fits into the larger context? This is sort of going along with a lot what's been happening throughout the country, isn't it?
It really is. If you look at sort of a map of the U.S., particularly in the Midwestern states and the Plain states, you know, a number of those states have allowed this kind of permitless carry, as it's called, or this bill would be called, that you could carry a gun without a permit. And so in this sense, you know, Iowa is sort of moving in the direction of some of these other Midwestern states. Now, that's not the case with some East Coast states, and particularly with the up and down the West Coast, where this is not really allowed. So I guess this legislation in that sense is being similar or conforming to other states within the Midwest here. There would still be, by this legislation, I thought it was interesting to note, that if you wanted to carry your gun to another state, though, even if they had permitless carry in their state, you know, whether they would accept, somebody from Iowa. And so you would that would encourage you to get a permit in Iowa. So if you wanted to, say, travel and do hunting in South Dakota or North Dakota or something like that, that you would still have to, at least in terms of a handgun, would have to have this kind of permit. So, I mean, there are some idiosyncrasies here that should be taken into account. But in large measure, I think your point is, you know, is on the mark, that Iowa is really moving in the direction of some of these other states within the region.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to other political topics, let's take this call from Lisa in Ames. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the program. You have also a comment on our gun violence debate.
Yes, I do. Thank you so much for your time. I'll make it fast. I'm a recent domestic violence survivor myself. I left a 3-year physically violent relationship in December. He is a convicted felon. He had guns in the home. And when I moved out of the home, by that point, he had been listed as the respondent in my restraining order. The deputy who supervised my visit discovered the guns that were just laying right there in the garage. This gentleman had strangled, you know, choked me at more than one occasion and said he was going to blow my head off and just throw my body in a ravine. And as of yet, nothing has been done about this. The sheriff in that county informed me I needed to just get over it and move on with my life. The other irony with that is the sheriff admitted to me that he had bought an RV from my abuser in September. Mm-hmm. And so my comment on this is, we can do lots of legislation, but when law enforcement agencies don't follow through with their obligation, it does no good whatsoever. It has to be enforced. The other vignette with this is to why I'm just not moving on with it and letting it go. My daughter is a freshman at University of Colorado. She runs for the cross country and track team. So I called her that afternoon after the news break to make sure she was safe. And she said, Mom, I just finished a run. I normally run right in front of that grocery store, but my gut told me not to go down that way. And so she didn't. And she said shortly after her run is when she heard the ambulance and law enforcement vehicles. So I am just really just, I'm still traumatized from all of this. And I'm just really tired that we have the laws in place, but certain law enforcement, they don't do what they need to do with it. And so, I'm just real curious as to what the panel has to say about that. And I thank you so much for your time here.
Lisa, thank you so much. And our heart goes out to you as a domestic violence survivor there. We're glad you're in a safer condition now. And of course, so glad that your daughter in Colorado is out of harm's way. Certainly, and when you hear news like that and your daughter is in Colorado, we all feel for you, Lisa. Thank you for your call. You take care.
Thank you.
Let me toss this to you, Donna. As a mother, also a political scientist, your heart had to go out to Lisa as well. But to wrap up this conversation and move on to some other things, I mean, we have so many aspects of this debate. How do you enact any legislation that would be effective? Lisa raising the thing, the comment about law enforcement having to enforce any laws that are in place or would be in place in the future.
Right. This obviously is a gut-wrenching issue, and it touches many people's lives in a very personal way. And this is, you know, there's two things that Lisa raised that are important that have not been in the discussion we've had so far, and that is the connection of domestic violence with gun violence, and then also the issue of law enforcement. You know, so at the same time that the gun debate kind of waxes and wanes in this country, as we talked about in the first part of the hour, and oftentimes it is connected to these mass shootings, we are also having a debate over a big general topic of law enforcement in this country that has been going on for, you know, many years, but took an added impetus perhaps this summer with the George Floyd death. And so correspondingly, there is also a debate in this country, both at the state level and at the federal level, about issues of law enforcement. And, you know, that goes to illustrate, I think, the way that many of these public policy problems that Americans confront, we might want to talk about them in isolated buckets, but in fact, there is a lot of overlap here. And many times reforms that we do, if we treat them, these problems as kind of isolated ones, can have unintended effects as well. And so these are, you know, very hard problems for policymakers to deal with. And these are things that must be kept in mind as, you know, legislators at the state level and the federal level talk about things that they want to change, policies that they want to make, because we know policies have intended consequences, but policies can have unintended consequences as well.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman with us and Jim McCormick, our two political scientists on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's dive into at least one or two other topics before our hour ends. Jim, I want to have your thoughts on this because, of course, any new president who comes into office has a vision, plans, but then to whatever degree ends up reacting to what happens during that administration. We are, I believe, 62 days into the Biden administration. Infrastructure, climate, equality, those we're hearing in our news are the pillars of Joe Biden's plan to reshape the American economy. We remember in his campaign last year, he described that phrase, this package with the phrase, build back better, an attempt to create a more prosperous and equal and sustainable economy. We don't have many details yet, but we do hear that the way to pay for it, the biggest source of money, would be higher taxes on the affluent, people making at least $400,000 a year, and taxes on corporations. Jim, what are your thoughts about this huge, huge vision that Biden seems to have for a major reshape of the American economy?
Well, I think this is really a campaign commitment that he's made. And this is, I think, needed, certainly on the infrastructure side. There's no question that, you know, bridges and roads and, you know, getting broadband access here are really fundamental kind of concerns here. I guess as with all of these plans, you know, how do you pay for them? And, you know, this proposal to tax those that are, you know, making $400,000 or more and to raise the corporate rate, I think it's up to 28%. It's at 21% right now. I think part of the debate is really going to turn on how do you pay for mm-hmm. these sorts of items here. And I think there will be, frankly, if the there's been talk that they will separate out the bills into two, one on just the infrastructure issue and the other on maybe on education and health care. I'm not sure which one will have the tax increases in it. It seems to me that getting the infrastructure materials in train here would be more effective to go ahead and get a Republican and Democratic agreement on. And then sort of the second bill, which you might just call this kind of recovery plan, you know, on education and health and child payments and so on, is where you might incorporate the tax. And that bill might be run through this reconciliation process, which would not require any kind of cooperation on the part of Republicans. So I envision, I think that, you know, so the report that they might separate out these bills, I think it probably will be what we will see. And this will also serve a very important political purpose for the Biden administration, because if they can get on the infrastructure side some cooperation from the Republicans, they can certainly make claims that they're moving towards this kind of unity here that the president made a statement about in terms of his inaugural address. So I do see him going forward with this, you know, in the very short term, because there's always this sort of narrow window of a new president. A new president wants to get everything done within the first year, because after that, not only is there an election coming up, but also the opposition starts to gel, it seems to me, mm-hmm. in terms of these kind of plans. So I think that's what sort of the what we can see is in terms of the immediate future here.
Donna, your thoughts on the major reshape of the American economy that the Biden administration has in the offing?
Yeah, it's certainly a very ambitious project, and Jim covered the elements of that relatively well. The only thing I would add to his comments are, in talking about, you know, the reconciliation process, which Democrats could use in the Senate to avoid a legislative filibuster, they can use that if Democrats hang together, because they can't lose even a single one in a 50-50 Senate in this sense, and the vice president could be brought in to break a tie. And so Democrats have to hang together on that. And this is certainly a moving target in this sense, right? We had a running joke in the Trump administration about it being infrastructure week, right? Because this was one of the things that traditionally you can get Democrats and Republicans to cooperate on and maybe move something down the road. So it still remains to be seen in a new Biden administration whether they're able to move this. But this is the time to do it, as Jim mentioned, is that first year and a first term that is really critical for moving a president's domestic agenda.
Mm-hmm. Joe Biden and his campaign touted his decades of experience, Donna, as a senator and as a vice president under President Obama. Are you seeing in these first 60-some days Biden's lessons learned from all of that experience in Washington in the way he is approaching his presidential agenda?
Yeah, I think I am. And I might take the example of the American Rescue Plan that was most recently passed. You know, so, for example, the Biden administration's plan was $1.9 trillion. Republicans countered that with $600 billion, I believe it was. Biden invited some key Republican members of Congress to the White House early on to talk about that. But then the bill that passed
was $1.9 trillion. And so you see a number of I think, lessons there. Consult with your opposition. Now, he didn't take into consideration their plan. I've seen some people liken that to, you know, you list your house for $1.9 trillion, but somebody offers you $600 billion. You're not really going to take that seriously. But he listened to them. He invited them in. The other thing was the American Recovery and Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was done in the aftermath of the Great Recession, is in hindsight, and even at the time, was considered to be too small to boost the economy. And so I think the Biden administration learned from that and went big on the American Rescue Plan. And so I think there you at least see two lessons that Biden has drawn upon, both in his experience with Congress consulting, even if you don't take, you know, those recommendations into account, but also learning that crises times may require really going big.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend the last few minutes talking about the real challenge on our southern border. President Biden made a commitment to a more humane immigration policy than his predecessor, Donald Trump. Jim, now Biden is trying to contain this burgeoning humanitarian crisis on our southern border with Mexico. We've seen a sharp rise in the number of migrants fleeing violence, natural disasters, also economic hardship in Central America. We're hearing in our news now every day officials here in the U.S. struggling to house, to process this increasing number of unaccompanied children, many of whom have been stuck in border stations for days while they await some placement in the overwhelmed government-run shelters. Jim, you first on this. Your assessment of this surge, it's something that also President Trump and President Obama faced, the surge on our southern border and its political implications.
My immediate reaction is that I think the Biden administration never expected the kind of numbers that we're seeing here. They were clearly, you know, unprepared to handle this. And I think in the first weeks of it, my assessment is that their response was really quite slow. And arguing over whether it's a crisis or whether it's a circumstance or whether it's a challenge seemed to me to really be misplaced here. There were really people that needed to be issues that needed to be addressed, people that needed to be helped, children that needed to be helped. And I think this is going to be, and it really, it took the shine off of, if you will, and all of this kind of victory lap that the Biden people are going to take over the passage of the $1.9 trillion, that it really has eclipsed it in the news coverage here. And so I think that my immediate response was that they simply were unprepared. And I must say that hearing on the Sunday talk program the Secretary of Homeland Security saying that the border is closed and things are in good shape here, it was quite disingenuous. I was disappointed, frankly, in the response.
Don, I have a couple minutes left of our program. Do you share Jim's criticism of the current administration?
Only in part. We should note that data actually shows that migrant surges are cyclical. As you noted, Obama had one, Trump even had one. They are cyclical, and we're at the beginning of a cycle in terms of the migrant surge. The data shows it's seasonal. And also in terms of research, it is pretty clear that when there are changes in immigration enforcement, in laws, in administration, those who want to come to the United States aren't deterred. They may delay when they come. They may change their routes when they come. And so, again, this is something that's being talked about in kind of a 24/7 news cycle. But if you look back at kind of the history here, this is something that, in fact, is cyclical. Now, I would share Jim's criticism in terms of they can look at the data as well as anybody else and see that this is cyclical. And they also knew that much of the infrastructure related to handling migrants at the border, handling asylum seekers, has long been underfunded, immigration judges in short supply, those kinds of things. They should have prepared for those kinds of things because those things were foreseeable in that sense. And they weren't. But this is, again, you know, the, what did you mention, 62, 64 days into an administration, in a time when the, you know, transition was also abbreviated as well. And so they weren't, in fact, probably as prepared as they needed to be in terms of handling the surge, which is actually fairly predictable in this sense.
Okay. Thank you very much for your views this hour. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim and Donna, always a pleasure to have you on and to have your insights tossed around and discussed. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Well, tomorrow on the program, we'll discuss discrimination against Americans of Asian descent, also anti-Asian racism, and the rise of hate crimes against Asian Americans. Part of tomorrow, you'll be hearing my conversation with Lynn Ta. She's an Asian American journalist based in Des Moines. You've heard her on this program before. Also, I'll talk with a criminal justice scholar at Iowa State University tomorrow on the program. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Talk again tomorrow.
Iowa is known far and wide for corn and soybeans, but those of us who live here know that Iowa is so much more. I'm Charity Nebbe. From agriculture to high culture, each day on Talk of Iowa, I talk to farmers, artists, authors, musicians, scientists, athletes, and others who make Iowa what it is. Talk of Iowa, weekday mornings at 10 on Iowa Public Radio.